720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing your part of your Saturday with us. Always grateful to you for that. Lots to do on the program today. A little bit later, we're going to be taking a look at the rental market in Chicago. There's some really interesting numbers up there, and some of it is kind of surprising. So we're going to take a look at what all that looks like and what it means for renters and for builders and developers. But right now, we're joined by Robert Chanik, business reporter at Chicago Tribune, and certainly a regular voice on this program. Hi, Robert. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Can I say you bet?
Sure. Uh-huh. Well, you are here indeed to talk about sports gambling in Illinois, so I suppose you bet would be the perfect thing to say. So take us through this, because I feel like we've been kind of hearing about this as being a thing on the horizon for such a long time. I think a lot of people have perhaps lost track of the nitty-gritty of it. So talk us through where we're at right now.
Well, one reason it's coming up in Illinois is Governor Pritzker, in his inaugural budget, put in some revenue for sports betting. So clearly it's a priority. They want to see sports betting in the next fiscal year, which starts this summer. So it's on a fast track, and there's no specific legislation proposed yet. But a number of states have added sports betting since the Supreme Court ruling last year. New Jersey had challenged a 1992 law that prevented states from having sports betting and prevailed. And since then, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, a handful of other states have added sports betting, and Illinois is kind of lining up to do the same. So legal sports betting, that's the idea.
And so what is the next step? I imagine there's a lot that legislators need to look at in terms of just what that would look like and how, where it takes place and all of those kind of details of the logistics of it.
Absolutely. In the states that have passed it so far, like I said, New Jersey, Pennsylvania being good examples, the sort of existing gambling platforms, casinos and racetracks, they've been sort of first in. So you have it at places like that. There's, you know, a limited number of licenses the state makes available, but the entrenched gambling interests, of course, want first crack. And so far, that's how it's played out, along with some online betting. But that's in Illinois, the casinos certainly want to be able to offer a sports book like you find in Vegas. Vegas and Nevada, of course, were the one exception to the rule. They've had sports betting for years. But, you know, in a casino, you walk in, you see the big screens and people able to place bets. I mean, that's what they're trying to do with casinos in Illinois and other venues like that.
And did you get a sense in working on this story of how licensing and regulation would work? Because that's such a big component of that, of course, you know, as everyone knows, in Vegas and all of that. But what would that look like here?
Well, the original, you know, rough proposal that the governor put forward is to have 20 licenses that would sell upfront for $10 million a pop, and that's the revenue they budgeted for next year if they can get it, $200 million. And you have 10 casino boats in Illinois, 3 racetracks. If you allocated a license to each of them just as a, you know, starting point, you have, you know, the video gaming operators, which is a big booming business where establishments have the video gaming machines and so forth. They would certainly like to be in the mix, online purveyors, et cetera. So they would have to figure out, you know, if say 20 were the number, once you got past the likely ones, casinos and racetracks, you know, a handful of others get doled out, and then that's the place you could do it. I mean, it would be limited to those licensees.
And as you note in the story, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program, because there's a lot of really good information in there. I want you to be able to read for yourselves. But you mention the issue of having to compete with bookies, because, of course, they're, you know, mm-hmm. like it or not, there is a pretty large offshore online betting component to this. And so how would that part work, where you would, at no point, I think, does anything become legal and suddenly everybody just does the legal thing. I'm sure there's still plenty of illegal gambling that would happen. What is the plan to address that and work out, just user mm-hmm. behavior between the two?
Well, as you're saying, it was hard to get an exact number because it's illegal, but, you know, multi-billion dollar industry right now. In, you know, people, a good chunk of the money goes to these offshore online betting platforms. Bovada was a big one, Five Dimes, et cetera. And people use those online resources here to make the bets. And again, we know it's a big business. Bookies, that's the old school way, of course. And in fact, I was reading and learning that bookies are often using those same offshore, websites to actually place the bets too. I mean, it's a big part of the business has moved online. And in fact, they're early adopters. I know I'm digressing. Like 80% of the business in New Jersey, for example, is online. So the whole industry has sort of shifted there. But to compete, I mean, what you have to do is there's really two things. First and foremost, illegal betting is generally not taxed, right? You're betting in some offshore site or your bookie. I mean, there could be another price to pay, but taxes aren't an issue. So states are all over the board right now trying to figure out what the right tax is. They want to generate revenue, and Illinois is, clearly that's a big chunk of it. Illinois is tentatively set the tax rate at 20%. But, the experts say you got to keep it competitive, and New Jersey is like 8.5%, I think, for the in-person betting, 13% online. So people will say, hey, yeah, this, make it attractive. One of the experts I talked to said, people would like to do it legally, but if you tax them 50% for it, they might not change their habits. So you got that. And then I think the fact that so many people like to bet online, it's a big consideration. I mean, if Illinois just does land-based, I should say, riverboats are not quite land-based, but, retail betting, it may not be as attractive as if they offer an online option as well. So those are the kind of considerations in terms of luring people away from the black market.
Yeah. One detail in the story that I thought was so interesting, that it was one of those, you read it and, of course that exists. And that was what you noted in there about geo-tracking, how online betting accounts, accounting for such a big, big swath of this, that one way to make sure people are just using it in the place where they're supposed to be using it is to use geo-tracking on the mobile app, so that to ensure that people aren't using it from outside the area, or to use it, to reach other centers of gambling, which I think is so interesting. I think there's probably a whole other conversation we could have just around technology of gambling at all.
And I've heard they've refined it, but the bottom line is, New Jersey has legal online betting, and you're in New York, which is actually about to probably come online as well. But, they want to make sure that folks in New York can't just load up their app and start betting in New Jersey. Since it's not legal to bet in New York right now on sports betting. So, yeah, they've worked it out, just like all the other things that get tracked on your smartphone. You cross state lines and the app doesn't work, and that's kind of how they protect themselves and limit it to the states that pass it. Interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's really, really interesting. And again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and share this story so you can read it for yourself. Lots of good stuff as ever. Robert Chanik, business reporter at Chicago Tribune, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Amy. Enjoyed it.
Good one. All right. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, more of this fun here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. Griffin, question for you. There's a topic that we talk about a little bit on the show, but not that much because it's still kind of a new space, and that is the area of fintech, which is financial technology.
Right.
Right. Have you ever used any of those kind of apps? There's so many of them, but I wonder if... So
these are like apps on your phone that help you manage your finances.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really interesting piece in The Ringer, which I will tweet out after the program, but it's kind of taking a look at these, and it brings up a really interesting point in this piece, because it's taking a look at all these different apps and what they do and all that. But one point that it brings up is that there's still so much taboo around talking about money. And here we have the millennial generation, where there's young people who have entered a really rough economic time, have entered a job market where there's wage stagnation and there's a lot of issues and there's a lot of student debt and a lot of financial things not stacked in their favor right now.
Well, and even for people doing well, there's a lot of anxiety about...
Absolutely, yeah.
Talking openly about having money or not having
exactly
money.
Exactly where, yep, I was going with it. Yeah, it's like that. Like even in the best of times, there's taboo around talking about money.
Absolutely.
People don't you don't want to say like what you earn or what you don't, or people are kind of sheepish about admitting when they're broke or something like that.
I think that's totally true. And it's notable because we've seen other taboo topics kind of lessen or fall away.
Absolutely.
And I think money is one that remains
still there.
Like, yeah, it has not really gone down the way we've seen other topics.
Yeah.
People's anxieties about talking openly about other topics.
Yeah. So to me, what's interesting about this sudden uptick of all these financial apps that kind of in some ways sort of gamify the idea of saving or learning about your money or looking for better credit card rates and things like savings rates, things like that, is that it's kind of answering this. Okay. If you feel embarrassed about something and you want an answer, you turn to the internet. You know, if you're yeah. sheepish about asking a friend like, hey, I'm broke and I don't know how to manage my money, then you're gonna Google that. You're not gonna ask somebody because you're gonna feel embarrassed. I think with anything that's taboo, that's why.
Yeah, and you've grown up with this technology anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're comfortable using it for that.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I've tested a few of them. I think they're interesting.
We had a guy on from Tip Yourself.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that guy.
Yeah.
Which was
a while ago.
That felt a little different because that one that was connected to positivity to me because you would go onto the app and say, I stuck to my diet today, or I went to the gym, or I had a good day. I'm going to put $10 in my tip jar, your virtual tip jar. So it was like a way to kind of praise yourself for good behavior by saving a little extra and making a positive association with
right.
saving.
And what I found with a couple of these, I mean, they all approach the same thing
yeah.
in different ways, right? So you're talking about that's more positive, but it is also just reallocating money. You still have all the same money that you would have had, just putting it away in a different place. Changes the way that you think about it.
Yeah,
right?
Some of them do, some of them don't. I mean, there's
right.
a point in this piece from The Ringer about how sometimes it does give you a false sense of like getting somewhere when you're not really doing anything per se. I
right.
mean, there's a couple of them that I like looked at and just to kind of understand them that I was going to be, you know, talking about them a little bit on the show. So I was playing with them and looking at Trim and Charlie. They both work kind of in the same way. And they basically will text you or messenger you or whatever you want. They'll notify you every time certain things happen and they're looking for deals for you. So for example, hey, your Comcast bill, whatever, your whatever utility just hit your bank account on autopay. Do you want us to go negotiate a better deal? And if you do, then you give a cut to the app. Some of them are just like, hey, a big expense hit. And you're like, yeah, I know. It was my rent. I can't get out of that. You know, sometimes it just kind of alerts you so you don't get overdrawn. But sometimes it's about, hey, notice you just made a credit card payment. Do you want us to look for a better rate? Looks like you have this rate. So sometimes it's like about education and having kind of an advocate. But I do understand that idea that it could lull you into a false sense of like, man, I'm on top of my money game. You're like, no, I'm broke as ever. I'm not doing anything different. I just maybe know that I could get a better credit card or something like that.
Right. Well, it's the same thinking patterns that you might get into if you didn't have the app, right? Like you can think positively or objectively, efficiently. There's some word that I'm looking for here, but there's like a good way to think about the way you're using your money, a productive way.
A productive way.
And then a not productive way. And like you're basically, sometimes it feels to me with these apps, it's just throwing in an intermediary.
That's exactly right. I think it's giving you a little, it's delivering information that you would otherwise have to go find.
Right, right. That's true. So do you like... You said you were kind of testing those out.
Well, yeah,
you
said
Trim and what's the other one?
Charlie. I thought Charlie was annoying. It's like a little penguin. I got rid of it right away.
Do you see yourself continuing on with those?
You know, I think what was interesting about Trim is that initially when you log in with your stuff, it gives you a lot of information about how it's protecting your data and taking your privacy very seriously. But then it immediately starts looking at all your bills and says, looks like you pay this every month. Hey, do you want us to go look it for a better rate? And I thought, yeah, that's never going to work. They actually did. They like, I didn't do anything. All I had to do was say yes. And they went to my internet company and they did get me a better rate. All I had to do was hit the button that said yes. And then
right.
they took a, I think, $9 cut of the, you know, $40 I would save of the year. I'm like, okay, that was easy enough. So, you know, jury's still out because I just kind of started playing with it. But I think it's interesting. It's an interesting idea to kind of help you. If nothing else, it saves you a little bit of time for hunting for information. Because, you know, the idea of like, okay, all day Saturday, I'm going to sit down and Google all these financial things and learn some things and see if I can get better rates. That sounds kind of exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
So if nothing else, it's kind of like a, it's a, like having an assistant.
Yeah,
to do some stuff for you.
Just maybe make you a little more intentional about the way you use your money and just think about it. Just something that forces you to think about it at all.
Yeah.
In some people's lives, probably mine. I don't have any of these yet, but I would think about it. Would be a force for good.
Yeah. It does text you when it says, like, here are the incoming transactions today. And if you spend a bunch of money on something stupid, you know, if you're like, you spent more money at Target than you meant to, you that comes to you in a text, you know. And so you're like, oh, yeah, I did go in for yogurt and leave with sheets, yogurt, grapefruit, and an iron. And, you know, like all the stuff. It does make you aware of, like, oh, I spent 50 and I meant to spend 5. Okay. You know, not that anyone ever leaves Target spending $50.
Yeah.
Because the Target phenomenon.
This piece makes a point that a lot of these companies are very closely associated with each other, because we're just throwing out names here, but I don't know of one that has more name recognition or has a stronger foothold in this sort of burgeoning industry.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like anyone's really owning the space.
No, and completely. It's an interesting point they make where a competitor's misstep reflects poorly on all of them, mm-hmm. because everyone thinks of them in the same pool. Which is an interesting place for like a certain technology to be at, where you'd think that your competitors, any misstep they make is good for you. And this is a point in this sort of pool of companies where they need people to trust all of them, or at least have more trust in this kind of system.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
And putting your money into an app that you'd barely know anything about. If another company that's similar misuses it or is less trustworthy, that reflects poorly on you.
That's an interesting point. I was just sitting here trying to find the name of an app that I just saw advertised to me, and it's specifically for people who don't have just one job. So many people have several jobs. A lot of people use like 1099s instead of getting a W-2, so your employer's not taking taxes out. And there's an app that you can attach to all your banking, and it automatically is like splitting up each deposit that you make into your account. It'll automatically split it up and set aside enough. It'll say, where do you live? Okay, these are the taxes you'll be responsible for. And it'll take a look at here's your total income amount. So this is the tax rate you would use. And it'll automatically set aside what you'd need for state and federal tax filing at the end of the year, set aside a little bit for health insurance. And if you want, you can even add, set up sick days for me, set up vacation for me. And it'll set aside a little money for you each time you deposit a check, so that you can in theory have like quote unquote paid vacation, but essentially you would cover yourself and not have to, because that's a problem with a lot of freelancers. Right. You can't take vacation because you can't, you know, it's not paid, so you can't really afford to take the time off. So this will help you, even just like pennies at a time, kind of help you do that, which I think that would be interesting. I mean, I have 7 jobs, so I'm all for that idea. I think that would be interesting because, you know, I know tax time is very stressful when you have more than one job, because there's a lot of stuff going on with and a lot of difficult things to wrangle.
So yeah, and it is nigh.
If I find that, I will tweet the name of that out, because it's going
to
drive me
crazy. Oh, yeah, we can come back to that, too.
For sure. Okay, well, we're going to take a break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Still lots to do on the program. We're joined now by Albi Galoon, senior reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, who recently wrote about the boom of apartments in downtown Chicago and how demand only seems to be increasing. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Amy.
So talk us through this, because it seemed like a lot of signs towards the end of last year were pointing to perhaps we were going to get in a little bit of trouble in terms of supply and demand and all the different stakeholders of builders, developers, landlords, and tenants. But it seems like that might not be the case, according to your reporting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, this is kind of a classic real estate cycle where you have developers building a lot of units or a lot of space at the tail end of a boom, and then, you know, demand falls off and you have too much supply because developers have overbuilt. But, and that did seem to be the case in downtown Chicago at the end of last year. There was going to be a big surge in supply this year, and there still is. But the thing that's amazing is that demand is keeping up, and actually, you know, it looks like demand actually could exceed supply over the next couple of years. So the outlook is really bright if you're a landlord. If you're a renter, I think you might want to expect more rent hikes.
Well, so what do you attribute this to? Because I'm sure a bunch of people just heard that and thought, oh, no, the rent, more rent, what am I going to do? So what factors led to this?
Well, the core driver of the housing market is really the economy and the job market. So when companies are hiring, that leads to household formation, and then you know, if you're a person and you're trying to decide, you need to decide whether you want to buy a place or whether you want to rent a place. So they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And so that's really the core driver here. But there's some other factors in play, too. I mean, if you look about 12, 15 years ago, the housing market was flipped the other way around, and everybody was buying condos and nobody was renting, at least in downtown Chicago. And so now we've got the opposite case where, you know, there have been developers have built almost 21,000 apartments in downtown Chicago since 2011. And over that same period, developers have only built roughly 1,000 condos in downtown Chicago. So it's really quite remarkable how the market has flipped on its head. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with people preferring to rent because they don't want to be tied down by a mortgage. You have millennials who are deferring marriage and having children. And then, you know, I think you have on the margin, you've got a lot of empty nesters who are selling their homes in the suburbs and moving into the city and renting an apartment rather than buying a condo. So there are a lot of factors at play, but those are a few of them.
And so as you note in this piece, which for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and share this after the program so you can read it for yourself, because there's some really good information and some great charts that I want you to be able to take in and see for yourselves. But as you note in the piece that new supply, meanwhile, will remain high, but it's tapering off. Is that just about saturation, or is there an underlying cause for why supply might taper?
Well, there are you have construction costs going up. And so that makes it harder for developers to build new apartments. There are affordable housing regulations that, you know, are making it harder for, or just making projects less profitable for developers. And, you know, we've been at this very high level, and, you know, you've also, you know, lenders are maybe a little bit more cautious as well. So those are factors that might be, keeping, you know, development from increasing. It's still at a very high level. It's kind of crazy because in 2017, developers delivered about, 4,300 apartments in downtown Chicago, and that was a record. Last year, developers finished 4,200. This year, it's going to be 4,000, and then the following 2 years, it's expected to be like 3,500. These are numbers from Integra Realty Resources, which is a consulting firm that tracks the downtown apartment market. So those are still really high levels. So, and, you know, what's remarkable is that demand has kept up with that every step of the way, and it's actually been growing, and we're well into the real estate cycle. I mean, the market has been moving up really since like 2010. And so we're 9 or so years into it. And, you know, this is about the time. It's, you know, people are asking questions about how long can this last? What inning are we in? And it seems like we're, you know, it's a bit cliche, but we're in extra innings here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does seem that way. And I feel like you're exactly right. Even kind of looking around on social media, just kind of getting a pulse on what this conversation is. It seems like there's a lot of that kind of, it seems like this bubble's going to at any minute now, but oh, well, I'm going to go ahead and do this. There seem like that kind of conversation, particularly from people who are renters, who are kind of in the thick of it and have a stake in that game in that way for sure. So in working on this story, what surprised you the most? Was there a data point that stood out that seemed different or surprising, or was it that we're in extra innings?
Well, I think it's just that demand is keeping up with supply, if not exceeding supply, and rent growth continues. I mean, by one measure, rents in Class A buildings, which are, you know, the most expensive buildings in downtown Chicago, rose about 5.5% last year. I mean, that's pretty astounding for where we are in the cycle. So that number really jumped out at me.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it might be interesting too to keep an eye on the next couple of years as conversations have really sprung up, I think, in the last year, especially around rent control and around tenants v. landlords. I think those conversations seem like they're bubbling up and getting louder and louder. So I think that might be an interesting conversation to have here at some point too. So thank you so much for joining us today, Albie Galoon, senior reporter at Crain's Chicago Business.
Thank you, Amy.
Talk to you next time. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Nice music choice, Griffin. I enjoy that.
Well, this is, you can thank Bob Kessler in the newsroom for this one. I saw his face light up when he heard it.
A trip to the past and the future.
That's
right. What are we listening to there?
Space 1999.
Okay, the theme song from Space 1999.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, well, the news story about SpaceX.
Yeah, which is so interesting. I feel like we've talked about Elon Musk so many times on this program, but mostly about his temperament and often questionable business decisions. But today, a test flight launched just before 3 a.m. Eastern on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, which is, you know, any time it's safely done, it's exciting. When it's not safely done, it's not so exciting. But certainly, you know, space exploration and the business of space is an interesting one. One we've talked about in this program, I think last time we talked about it, we were talking about how Amazon is already trying to make headway into getting cargo in the event that Elon Musk is able to colonize Mars, do all those things. This ship is not headed to Mars. It is headed to the International Space Station. And there's some interesting stuff. I know I say this all the time, but I want to give you links to all the things we talk about on the program. So if you're following me on Twitter, I'm going to be sharing these after the show. But there is there's a really interesting piece in the Washington Post about this launch that's kind of talking about the business of this and the business of all of it. And part of it is that NASA really needs to trust SpaceX, right? SpaceX is this kind of little like rogue younger brother, right? It's not affiliated with NASA, of course, but it's like it needs. NASA needs SpaceX to prove that it can get human beings safely to the space, into space, doing the things. Like, it has some ways to go because, as we know, there have been some, like, fairly high-profile, not good things that have happened in SpaceX tests.
Yeah, and they made in the words of this Washington Post story, they placed a bold bet on the private sector and outsourced human spaceflight to the International Space Station, which is what's happening today. I mean, there's no humans on that.
There's no people on
that flight.
Yeah.
We'll talk about it in a second. But they put it all in the hands of SpaceX and Boeing, and the companies won those contracts from NASA for a combined $6.8 billion. That was in 2014. So then, since then, it's been kind of a weirdly contentious working relationship between those two entities.
It has. And I think, like, so much has been on, so much of the conversation has been on SpaceX and some of their misfortunes, let's say. Let's not put blame anywhere and just say misfortunes. That Boeing really has not been part of this conversation for
right.
a long time. Like, it's almost it like faded to memory, like distant memory that, oh yeah, that's right. This is a thing that happened. NASA did, contract with both of them because SpaceX is who we've talked about, because Elon Musk keeps himself in the news quite a bit with some of his decisions.
Right. And two SpaceX rockets have exploded, one in 2015 and then another on the launch pad in 2016.
So here's a thing that I learned, and that is I spoke with someone who, you know, had some knowledge of SpaceX and company culture and had done some work there. And they do not say explosion. They say rapid unscheduled disassembly.
Ah.
So there's that. It is a rapid unscheduled disassembly.
That movie had the coolest rapid unscheduled disassemblies ever.
Right, right. Yeah. That movie was filled with unscheduled rapid disassembly. Right.
That's, I can't even say it. I was about to make the same joke, but it takes 30 seconds just to get that
out. It takes way too long to say. Because I think what you actually, I don't know, but I would imagine if something that you've spent a good deal of brain power and effort and you know, blood, sweat, and tears working on suddenly explodes, I don't think you're going to use that many letters. You're probably going to use like four. That's what I would do. That's what I would do.
It is funny too, like, you know, in the limelight, billionaires, like, say, I don't know, Elon Musk, for example, they do seem to kind of pride themselves on talking straight, especially him, where he's always on Twitter, just like, I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking in real time. That might get me in trouble, but I'm not here to put on airs or engage in this kind of like corporate speak. And then they do find themselves backing into it with a phrase like that. You know, it's always, you can find it anywhere you look in Silicon Valley, I think, but like, the ways that people who claim to not engage in the practices of big business that they grew up hating or wanted to change, they always find a way. Once you get big enough,
that's the thing. Yeah, once you're big enough and you have to run a huge corporation,
you engage in all the same tactics, and it's hard to avoid sometimes.
I think so.
I don't think that I'm not blaming them for that.
Good
but
or
it,
bad,
is,
it is
a funny.
Thing.
It is
a thing. Yeah, it is a thing when like a small business suddenly gets large enough to a point where like you might be avoiding some corporate speak and some corporate kind of things. You kind of gotta toe the line at some point.
Unfortunately, there was a reason the things were the way they were. So. Basically, there was just a lot of tension and there was a lot built into the launch today, and they were very nervous about it, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot's riding on it.
Yes.
To make sure that it works and it does what it says it does. And I think especially when you have a company like Boeing who has, you know, SpaceX is high profile in a different way, in an almost controversial way. It's a much younger company. Boeing is a huge company. And I think especially with that kind of huge iconic brand affiliation with Boeing, I think there is suddenly a different tone to the high stakes.
Right. And this is all happening on a Russia spacecraft, though, which is bizarre that they have to rent out seats for. And that seat is going to a dummy right now named Ripley.
Poor Ripley.
Named after Ripley from Alien.
From Alien,
which I enjoyed.
Which is great. Which is a great nod to that.
Hope everything goes well for her.
What do you think about, like, when we look forward kind of to, like, commercial space travel, where do you fall on that? Because I know some people have been like, sign me up first. As soon as I can afford it, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I do not. Look, I don't love to fly if I don't have to. You know, like, I do fly. I enjoy travel. But, you know, every time you take off and land, there's always a little bit of, like, just land safely. We've all seen that TV movie. We all know how this can go badly. We've all seen, horrible things happen, especially, you know, in this industry. We've had to write about and talk about and cover sometimes really scary things. And I think that, like, I'm always thinking of a particular TV movie. Every time I've ever landed near a body of water, I always think of that plane that went into the Potomac. I always think, and there was like that horrible TV movie made about it in the early 80s. I always think of that. Still to this day,
I don't think I deal with like a lot of anxiety about it, but I just don't think it'll. You know, these contracts were bought in 2014, right? It's 5 years later now, and they're launching a dummy for the first time. It seems to be going well so far. If it should dock on Sunday morning, tomorrow morning, if everything goes according to plan, and then come back in like 10 days, something like that.
Yeah,
that's if everything goes according to plan. If that happens, then there will be a launch for a real astronaut in June or sometime this summer. That's the schedule that they're currently on.
Yeah.
So that's moving pretty fast. But
couldn't pay me enough to be that astronaut. No way. Could not pay me enough.
And some people feel the exact opposite.
I'm
kind of somewhere in the middle. Like, but I just don't think that it'll be possible to, because ultimately that is some people's goal at the end of all of this, right? Commercial spaceflight.
Sure.
You'd take a flight of, I don't know, like an hour or something like that and pay.
Who knows?
But it would be so much in the early. I just don't think I'll be alive at a time where
it's attainable. No, I don't think it'll be
remotely attainable for anyone who's not insanely rich. Possibly not even them. Like, I still have a lot of doubts that this will be available to anybody, like, in
who
the
knows?
Near future.
Yeah,
but we don't know.
We don't know.
That's why I'm surprised by myself that I'm so interested in the story. But it's just like, I'm definitely curious to see what happens next.
I am too. I mean, I love space stuff. I love sci-fi, you know, films and TV shows. I love space stuff anyway. So here's this critical first step of making some of that real and this other uncharted area of exploration. It's exciting. It's interesting.
It is. Yeah. Bob's been trying to get me to watch Space 1999 for about 2 years. So
just watch it. Get him off your case. Lord.
Where in space there are no trees, but the acting is wooden. That's my slogan for it.
It's a really good sell, I have to say. It's very convincing.
It's a good bad show.
I threw him a bone with the theme song, so that'll keep him at
it's
bay.
It's a good jam.
Quiet for a while.
I think for a while,
okay.
Yeah.
we'll watch it, Bob. We'll, it'll be good. We're going to watch it. All right. We're going to take a little break and check in with Scott Catoon and all that good stuff coming up here in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, that about wraps it up for us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. New thing I want to mention for those of you who are regular listeners and appreciate the business topics, starting on Monday in a partnership between WGN Radio and Crain's Chicago Business, I'm going to be hosting a new daily podcast called Crain's Daily Gist. You can find that on iTunes. You can find it on the Crain's Chicago Business social media accounts and on their website. I saw an ad, Griffin. It's my face. I'm like, whoa, that's me.
Oh, really?
That's me holding a microphone.
Bus stop or something? Or?
No, there's going to be some signs going up. You'll see it around town, but on the on the Crain's Chicago Business website, you'll be seeing a lot of promotion for it. And if you subscribe to their daily newsletters, where you get kind of the business headlines, it'll be ready every day about 4:30, and you'll be able to get a link sent right to your inbox. But if you go to the site now, there's a picture of me looking very casual and laissez-faire in a podcast room that I have I've got my feet up on the wall.
So that goes up, you said, around 4 p.m.?
Yeah, around 4 p.m. every day.
And the name is, one more time?
It's called Crain's Daily Gist.
I can't wait to hear it.
Daily podcast. It'll be all about the top business stories right here in Chicago. So if you're into this topic because you're listening to this show, then perhaps you would be interested in that. And if you follow me on social media, you're going to hear a ton about it because I'm going to be tweeting about that a ton. Now, we are welcoming our good friend Scott Catoon to the studio. Hello.
How you doing? Congratulations, by the way, on that. That is so cool.
Thanks. That's pretty exciting. And, you know, everybody at Crain's is so great, and it's so cool to kind of work with these two places together. It's really cool.
One day off air, I want to know how that went together, because media companies don't necessarily always play well together. And so it's like...
Oh, I think we're all, at this point, we're all just kind of like fighting the same fight out there.
We're all swimming around just like, how can I help you? How can you help me? Just get me out of here.
I mean, I think as we get into new ways to deliver content to people, I think it makes sense to partner in different ways. And
I totally agree.
Yeah.
Especially since Crain's and WGN do their media different.
Absolutely.
It's like a great compliment. So.
And have, for the most part, very different areas of focus. You know,
totally.
Crain's, it does so much in-depth reporting just on Chicago business and just, you know, and owns some of those spaces of like 40 under 40 and some of those big...
I'd love to see John Pletz cover Technori a little more. That's what I'd like to see. No, it's all good. We have a good show, though. Really a big person in the show. The former VP of growth, Meyer Gupta from Spotify.
Oh,
he's
cool.
Now the CMO at Freshly, so he'll be heading off to New York. We've been trying to put this together forever. Finally, he's here, and he's brought his daughters, so it'll be a fun show.
What's Freshly about?
Well, we're going to find out. Okay. I mean, I've done like preliminary research. I don't have it in front of me, but you got me on the spot here. But
it's all good.
He's going to talk all about it. I believe it's another grocery via internet company.
Okay,
which the world needs more of.
I know.
Wait till Steve Grzanich finds out. And we're all in trouble.
That's right.
He's a bigger champion of it than of Tavala than I am, which is hard to do.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. I'll be listening.